In pitching, there is no one most effective way to get an opposing batter out. Frank Tanana was ample proof of that theory, but certainly not by his own doing. After earning a strikeout title and three straight All-Star appearances as a flamethrower with the California Angels, a shoulder injury in 1979 severely cut down his velocity. Instead of flaming out, he reinvented himself and went on to 240 victories over 21 seasons. So Frank, being born and raised in Detroit during the 1960s, a lot of kids your age who followed the Detroit Tigers idolized the great outfielder Al Kaline. Was that the case for you as well? And perhaps were there any pitchers that you wanted to emulate during that time as well?
Well, you know, of course, Al was the man, and great ball player, and certainly a favorite of many kids, and myself included. But being a pitcher. Mickey Lowich, being a left-hander like I was someone that I certainly looked up to and watched very closely as Mickey would pitch. And then Mickey, of course, was a very strong pitcher, a workhorse. He threw a lot of innings. And the other guy, too, back then was a great left-hander by the name of Sandy Koufax for the Dodgers. That was also somebody that is a young pitcher. I looked up to.
Thanks to your blazing fastball, you were a star at Detroit's Catholic Central High School and the first-round pick of the California Angels back in 1971. Joined the big league club in September of 73 at age 19. Eventually part of the same rotation as another power pitcher, the great Nolan Ryan. Like you, he also entered the big leagues at 19 years old. And when you came onto the Angels, he was just hitting his stride, recording no-hitters and striking out more than 300 in a season. What did you learn from Nolan, especially in the early years of your big league career?
Well, one of the things that from Nolan, Nolan was kind of his own distinct, threw as hard as him, and then no one struck out as many or really walked as many. As Nolan did. At that time, I had really pinpoint control and threw real hard. But the one thing that you learned from Nolan as I watched him was just the way in which he prepared to pitch a ball game, just the way he, how hard he worked. He would ride a stationary bike for like an hour after pitching a nine-inning ball game. So it really was his work ethic, and also Nolan was very intimidating on the mound and was not afraid to brush people back off the plate. And I like to do that the same, even coming into the game of baseball, pitching inside was part of my repertoire. To see again Nolan do it and to see how effective it was really helped me early on in my career.
This guy's one of the outstanding pitchers in the American League, Frank Tanana of the California Angels. All hard stuff. Good overhand curveball, good fastball.
I'll tell you what, he's one of the few pitchers, a lot of strikeout guys say, well, I don't really try for strikeouts. But he says, hey, I try for strikeouts. It's a feeling of power.
He led the American League in strikeouts, led the majors, as a matter of fact, last year in strikeouts with 269, finished fourth in the Cy Young Award voting last year.
You yourself had three consecutive 200-plus strikeout seasons, topping at a league best 269 in 1975. On June 21st of that season, you had 17 against the Texas Rangers. Your fastball would be clocked at 100 miles an hour at times, even more than that. But as you well know, a big league hitter can hit a fastball no matter how fast it's thrown if there isn't any movement and there aren't any other pitches to set it up. So for you during the 70s, how important were those off-speed pitches, especially your curveball, in making the fastball that much more effective and leading to those high strikeout totals?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. Big league hitters, if you've got one pitch, you could throw it 1,000 miles an hour, and these guys are great hitters. They can time you. My curveball was pretty unique. It was a big curveball. It wasn't a slider. It was a big curveball, and I changed speeds and I changed angles on my curveball, and also threw a changeup. Didn't throw it near as much as I did later on in my career, but understood the importance of changing speeds on both my fastball and my curveball. And from throwing it from different angles, Brian was able to give me a throw. It was really only 2 inches, a straight ball and a curveball, because of the angles and different speeds. It was a lot of pitches.
Some other impressive notes of your time in Anaheim include leading the American League in earned run average in 1977, making 3 straight All-Star teams from 76 through 78. But 1979 is when you came down with shoulder tendonitis and forced you to miss a good chunk of that season. Were there indications before that injury that something might be going wrong, or did it come somewhat by surprise?
No, all of 1978, Brian, I pitched with an arm that was less than 100%. And you can see by the numbers, though I won 18 ball games, which was quite an achievement for the fact that my arm really hurt all year long, my ERA, I think, was practically a run more than the 1977 season. You've got the numbers maybe in front of you, can verify that. But, yeah, it was oncoming. And you're hoping always as a pitcher, of course, that it's going to get better. But it really never did. And then it culminating with me having to just stop going for a while.
You did return late in that season when the Angels held a slim lead in the American League West, and as it turned out, you pitched a complete game against the Kansas City Royals on September 25th to clinch the division, the franchise's first playoff berth. Would you have tried to come back in September of 79 if there hadn't been a pennant race?
You know, that's hard to say. After hurting for so long, it was good to be feeling good again. Interestingly there, I worked with a fellow by the name of Keith Clevin, who was at that time the physical therapist for, he worked Larry Holmes, who was the heavyweight champion of the world, his corner. And Keith worked with me that summer and really got my arm pain-free and able to build it up to where I could pitch. And I probably would have because of the health that I was feeling and the building up of it. But I don't know that for sure. It certainly helped that we were in a pennant race, and it just added to the, I don't want to say rush to get ready, but it certainly helped in my preparation to try to get ready so that I could contribute and be a part of really what was at that time the best California Angel team that was, that I could be a part of. So I didn't want to miss coming in on the fun. These guys were scoring a lot of runs, and I hadn't experienced that early in my career. We didn't score very many runs, so I wanted to be a part of it.
Now it's up to Daryl Porter. Porter sends it to Carew. This should do it. He knocks it down. He goes to Tanaka. It's down. It's over. The Angels win. Greg Tanaka mobbed by his teammates. Carew, his teammates making their way to the dugout as the Angels, for the first time in 19 years, win the Western Division title of the American League. There's got to be some tears of joy and happiness as throngs of field come onto the field as the Angels back in the clubhouse right away. But the Angels defeat the Royals by a score of 4-3, and it took a gutsy performance by Frank Tanaka to do just that. Tanaka, suffering from tendonitis throughout the course of the year, missed 3 months of the season, but he came back to pitch one of maybe the greater games of his career.
Yeah, the 79 team unfortunately would lose to the Orioles in 4 games in the American League Championship Series. Now, the shoulder injury, which we mentioned earlier, necessitated a change in your pitching style, as you mentioned, from a power pitcher to a finesse pitcher, or a crafty lefty, as the baseball cliche goes. When did you...
Yeah, I like that one better.
When did you know, whether it was during your rehabilitation in 79 or afterwards, that you'd have to permanently change your style in order to keep going?
Well, that was a tough decision. I had hurt my arm a little bit coming out of high school, and I missed my first whole season of rookie ball. I never pitched an inning in 1971. And so now here we are, you know, in 79, and I'll go through another one, and I've got, you know, tendonitis real bad. I probably had, they weren't diagnosing at the time, but I think I probably had slight tears in my labrum around the shoulder. The rotator was fine. But through all that pain and having pitched with pain the entire 1978 season, Brian, I think, I was tired of that, certainly. And I would watch Tommy John. I'd see Scott McGregor, guys who didn't throw, you know, hard, but got the job done. They threw hard enough, and they seemed speed, and they were very effective, very outstanding big league pitchers. And so, with all of that in the mixture, my mind, I just decided that rather than taking a chance on one pitch, you know, trying to throw real hard again and his shoulder completely blowing out, I would change my style of pitching from throwing a majority of fastballs to really throwing a majority of curves and off-speed pitches fast, but not as near as fast, and saving whatever fast I had left for when I got in a jam or, you know, so kind of a changing of philosophy.
Now, were there any adjustments you had to make specifically to your motion in order to be a control pitcher? I mean, what was the learning adjustment like for you? I mean, how long did you think it took before you get acclimated to that style?
Well, it took a couple of years, and I didn't really need to change my motion a whole lot. But I threw across my body, kind of like Chris Sale throws these days, really a crossfire, where I would step towards the left-handed hitter's batter's box, more or less, and throw across my body. To take some of the stress and pressure off my arm, I began to throw my foot more directly at home plate. And so that was really kind of the major change. I really feel like I got some of the mental adjustment was difficult too at times. You know, you'd want to revert back to throwing hard, but I couldn't. I think 1984, I had a wonderful season with the Texas Rangers, and feel like everything kind of clicked into place as to how I was going to perform. Won 15 games that year with Texas and had a very good season, and so that was kind of the year I feel like at that time. Made that transition from one type of pitcher to being a successful another type of pitcher.
Yeah, going from the Angels, you'd be traded to the Red Sox after 1980, signed with the Texas Rangers in 82, and was traded to the Detroit Tigers in 1985. And this had to be an exciting time for you personally, not just going to your hometown team, but going to a team that had just won the World Series a year ago. And you had mentioned 15 wins with Texas in 84. But looking back, was that trade to Detroit also a moment that helped rejuvenate your career?
Yeah, no question, Brian. That getting traded to the World Championship team, Detroit Tigers, a great ball club. You know, just with outstanding players that practice at every position. And a good starting staff and a bullpen to become a member of that team and being from my hometown was definitely a shot in the arm and one that really rejuvenated my career because, again, when you're not striking out people and you can't do it alone, kind of win a game single-handedly if your team will just get you one or two runs, to now where you need your defense because you're putting the ball in play and you need some offense because you're going to give up a few more runs because they're just making more contact. To get traded to an outstanding ball club like the Detroit Tigers was, as it would be with any pitcher, highly beneficial to, again, helping me win more ball games and kind of establishing my career all over again as a good big league pitcher.
It's good to have, as you mentioned, those fielders behind you, especially the double play combination of Alan Trammell and Lou Whitaker, and not only them, but, you know, Jack Morris in the rotation, Kirk Gibson, Darrell Evans, a lot of veterans. No Hall of Famers, now that I think about the top of my head, no Hall of Fame players, but a lot of players that are very good.
I mean, you got Herndon and Lemon and Gibson and, you know, even a Tommy Brook and solid at third, Lance Parrish catching behind the plate. We were a great ball club. We really were, and would have liked to have won more with them. We were always in the hunt, but couldn't pull off any more. But these guys were gamers, Brian. They were great athletes and great great ball players.
We're at Tiger Stadium in Detroit on a gorgeous fall day with bright sunshine, clear skies, and a full house. And the standings in the American League East tell the tale. A win by Detroit today, and the Tigers go to the playoffs. A win by the Blue Jays today, and Toronto forces a one-game playoff tomorrow.
Your finest moment as a member of the Tigers came in the 1987 regular season finale against the Toronto Blue Jays at Tiger Stadium. Detroit held a one-game lead in the American League East over Toronto, which had lost six in a row and needed a win to force a one-game playoff. The Tigers and Blue Jays were quite familiar with each other over those last 2 weeks, having played six times before, all of the games being decided by one run. And the last one would be no different. You, in fact, had faced them in Toronto on September 25th, pitched seven shutout innings, and got a no decision. Those two factors, having pitched well against them recently and knowing it wasn't a do-or-die scenario for your team, did that relax you a bit in what otherwise would be a very nerve-wracking situation for a starter?
Well, there's no question. I had pitched very well, I think, before that game or even after that game all year long. In about 35 innings, I gave up two runs to Toronto. So pitching against them, they were a fine ball club, but one that, you know, sometimes you just kind of have a team's number, and your style of pitching fits well with them. They were a good fastball-hitting team, but had difficulty with off-speed stuff, and being a left-handed pitcher really, really helped. So that was contributing to my, as you said, maybe being relaxed. But, you know, no, it's really coming into it as a do or die. It was the highlight game of my career, pitching that ball game and helping Detroit beat the Toronto team. But like you said, they were stumbling. They'd lost two key players. Ernie Witt and Tony Fernandez were out. But still, we had chased them all season long and needed to beat them, and we did. And I beat a great left-hander in Jimmy Key that day, 1-0. And surprise of all surprises was I went 9 innings, which I rarely did anymore at that time in my career.
Yeah, Jimmy Key pitched a great game. Larry Herndon, I believe, a second-inning home run was the only run in that game, a 1-0 win. You allowed six hits, three walks, struck out nine. As you said, a complete game shutout to win the American League East. The final out would come on a soft ground ball back to you. Is a game like that, a low-scoring game, a pitcher's duel, somewhat helpful in you maintaining your focus as opposed to if you were staked to, like, say, like an 8-run lead or something, and you had been more susceptible to slipping up and letting the opponents get to you?
Well, you know, I think any time I took the mound, Brian, there was total focus and total concentration, and you learned that it was always best and advantageous to you to, regardless of the score, pitch as if it's a close ball game, staying sharp and concentrating. But I never really had any trouble doing that. Loved the game, loved pitching, loved the competitiveness of it, regardless of the score. So was able to stay in it. But you're absolutely right. I think if you're going to lose focus, you may lose it in a big game where you got a big lead. But with a low-scoring game, losing focus was not an option.
Two down, Orange is the batter. to Frank Tanana and Larry Herndon. Next stop, Minneapolis. Detroit wins the East.
Now, the run for the 87 Tigers ended in the American League Championship Series, a five-game loss to Minnesota. But that didn't stop Sparky Anderson from being named Manager of the Year for a second time. He would also win the World Series three times with the Tigers in 84, twice with the Cincinnati Reds, 75 and 76. Not just a great manager, but very likable around the baseball world as well. And he was your manager for your entire tenure in Detroit. What was it like for you playing for him?
Well, it was a wonderful experience. You know, Sparky and I had kind of a, I like to tell people, we had a love-hate relationship. I loved being on his team, and he hated the fact that I didn't throw very hard and really couldn't believe and understand how I got people out. But I did, but we had a good one. He was a veteran manager's delight. He backed his players to the hilt. Never once would you ever see him ripping. He had a great respect for his players. And, you know, you worked hard and did your very best, and you were on time for Sparky, or he would move you on. The thing I loved about him was the fact that he knew that we were family. We were going to spend a lot of time together. And he really developed a close-knit ball club and had players who had that same attitude, Brian, or they wouldn't play on his ball team. So not only a great manager, but really a wonderful leader of men, and talked us all up in the dugout and in the, not so much in the dugout, but in the clubhouse, because, you know, we'd hear some of the things he would say to the press, and we would just kind of have to roll our eyes and just shake our heads and laugh and just knew that that was just Sparky being Sparky.
After stints with the Mets and the Yankees, you retired in 1993 with 240 victories, 2,773 strikeouts. Since your playing career ended, you have been on the board of directors for the Pro Athletes Outreach. You're involved in home plate ministry, reaching out to younger people. We hear a lot of professional athletes who are somewhat at a loss or lost after their playing days end, not sure what to do, you know, if it's not broadcasting or coaching. But you found another passion in your life that's still going strong. How difficult was it at first to transition into retirement? And how fortunate do you feel to have this other outlet after your career?
Well, Brian, you know, coming to faith in Jesus Christ, and halfway through my career, November 6, 1983, I committed my life to Christ. And he became my passion, and he became my purpose for my life. So that when baseball, 10 years later, had come to an end, I had already been walking with Jesus for 10 years and saw that, you know, his purpose for my life was to tell other people about him and to live my life and love my wife and my kids and do things according to what the Bible has to say about living life and investing in other people. So that when my career was over, I was pretty mature in my faith and was able to understand and grasp and know that, you know, the career was soon going to be over. And when it was an easy transition for me, a very easy transition, because baseball, you know, sadly, rather than being a part of guys' life, is guys' life. And you take that away from them, then they're lost. They're like a fish out of water. But that wasn't the case for me because of what Christ was doing in my life, what he was doing in my heart, and just the wonderful purpose, like I said, that he gave me and has given me and will continue to give me until, you know, he takes me home.
Frank Tanana's status as a Detroit sports legend started with his standout days at Catholic Central High School, was heightened with his 240-win big league career, and was solidified when he joined the city's Sports Hall of Fame in 2006. That's all for this edition of Baseball As It Was. I'm Brian Wright. Thanks for listening.